This is WJBC This Week.
I thought we'd be better, to be honest. That I am somewhat disappointed in.
I'm first student. I would like to extend an apology to the district and to the families.
Allie treated the hospital like a fine hotel. I mean, she was the one that wanted to make sure, you know, you were happy.
The new Connect Transit bus network is a game changer.
I am not angling for any other spot, any other office.
So-
What'd you call me for?
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Unit 5 addresses its transportation woes during the first week of school. Connect Transit rolls out new bus schedules to Bloomington-Normal in hopes of being more accessible to its riders. An author explains why Denmark, not Disney, is the happiest place on earth. Another author who is coming to Bloomington shares all the many things that make her happy. Plus, the first female coach in Corn Belters history comes to town. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The first few days of school can be a trying time for students and their teachers. That first day of school was made even more stressful in Unit 5 by the transportation woes that plagued the district as it was employing new start times in an effort to improve its efficiency with a downsized fleet of buses. After that trying first day for many parents, Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
From what we're gathering, some kids were dropped off at the wrong location. Some kids weren't picked up at all. The buses were overcrowded. And on top of that, people were anticipating problems because it was the first day of a new system.
Yes. And I think that's important to realize. It is a new system. Plus, we have new start times with elementary being first. So I've surveyed the various principals, of course, and asked them provide me feedback, as well as the numerous parents that I've been in contact with. And we definitely have room for improvement. That's the good side of things, because we do realize we can make things better. All these things hinge upon ridership. And ridership is that moving target, if you will. We don't truly know what ridership is until the day students board that bus. So we do plan for overcrowding of buses. And again, part of that is we have to do our best to stay within this budget that we're holding to 121 routes. Last year we had up to 138 routes, 138 buses, if you will. But as you know, we're still at 70% funding from the state. We can't have a $1.4 million deficit. So that is not an excuse. That is reality. We have to deal with that. I am optimistic still that we can resolve these problems, i.e. students, specifically high school students and junior high students, three to a seat. Not our desire. We want that to be two. But again, we're starting to shift. That will happen throughout the next several days, shifting students and relooking or examining what buses may not be at capacity. But I will tell you, one of the things I was always a first day concern is, are students arriving to school safely and are they getting home safely? At the end of the day, everyone did. So that goal was reached. But we have improvement.
You say you don't know until the day comes how many kids are going to be on. Do you have an idea? I mean, this is a question that is asked of the student body or parents and what their plans are.
We know that we are accountable for 10,000 students. Now think about that number. 10,000 students that we have to at least have an idea of how we're going to bus. Now, in reality, all 10,000 students don't ride. So with the changing of times, I was at Pepper Ridge, for instance, yesterday morning, saw quite a few parents driving their students. That's a little bit different, but elementary again starting at 7:45, so we probably are going to see more parents dropping off students. On the other side of that, you have high school students and junior high starting at 8:30 and 8:45, so that may create maybe the reason why we're seeing more now riding in the secondary, in the tier two secondary fleet. So those things you're thinking about, but you don't know truly the actual numbers until that first day. Now, that means we have to be on board, ready to adjust and to adapt and ensure that, yes, those buses aren't, kids are not sitting on the floors. Kids are, and again, high school kids, when you place them three to a seat, that's tight. And we need to work on that. Plus, the other thing that we've had going on this week would be the amount of construction that we have throughout the city. And I have to say, Normal Community High School, we thought was going to be a major issue. It ended up being relatively minor. Rab Road not being open to Tawana Barnes. So that really didn't create a problem. We also had Town of Normal assisted us with some traffic control, a police officer there at the light of airport and Rab. So that flowed rather nicely. About 20, I believe there are 28 buses that flow through there. And I saw students, I was also out there yesterday afternoon, I saw those buses being loaded and some buses were rolling at 235. So, excuse me, not 235, but they're out at 330, so 335. So with that said, that went smoothly. But we need to concentrate on if we didn't pick up students when students should have been picked up, that's our error. We need to correct that today.
So what are you doing today? What is the objective today, obviously to make it run a lot, but specifically, what are you going to change today?
Well, we already looked at, as of yesterday morning, we saw approximately five buses that are overloaded. Those five buses have already, they have been examined. We are working on trying to spread those students to different buses, the ones that aren't overcrowded. So that the routers are working on that yesterday. Again, First Student is the company that we use to handle our transportation needs, and we're working very closely with them. So that was goal number one as we came out of our meetings yesterday morning. Yesterday afternoon, we were hoping that would be better than what it was in the AM, and actually yesterday afternoon, we had more issues than we anticipated. So they're working on ensuring that they know where each student is to be and who's picking that student up. Again, I sort of think of this as a, as you can imagine, this has been quite a bit on my, regards my thoughts and concentration. I see this as, you think of airports, and, you know, as we rush to the airport and we wait for an hour to board, and that airport and that plane is going from probably one destination to another destination, we board 10,000 students on buses, on 121 buses, and those buses do not go from point A to point B. They go from stop A to stop B, up to 15 to 20 different stops. Trying to get, and these are youngsters, in the right place at the right time. So it is a very complex phenomenon, much more complex than I've ever realized. But that's the situation in Unit 5. And we have to address it, and we have to ensure that, number one, students are safe. Number two, we're working to make the driving, the distance, I say, from point A to point B timely. And some of the parameters that we've tried to push, and we're working on those, continue to work on those. We really don't want elementary kids on the bus earlier than, we're looking at that seven-ish figure. That time frame. So we've done some creative things in that area. For instance, we have some people that are outliers, and you can imagine the very extremities of our district, which right. is, we have a very large district. So what do you do with those kids? Well, by using our own minivans, which is permissible, picking those, just a couple students up, impacts three other buses and gets those three buses to stops around 7 in the morning instead of 6:30. So we've been concentrating on the routes that are before 7. We've been concentrating on parents wanting to change stops, been dealing with that, and now we're going to concentrate on overloading. So you can see it's a very complicated puzzle.
That was Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel with Scott Laughlin. Bloomington Normal's public transit system, Connect Transit, completed a major transformation this week as it rolled out a dramatically new bus schedule in an effort to increase ridership. Connect Transit is boosting frequency of its most popular routes, while some outlying parts of town which have had lower ridership will see more limited service. It is also adding Sunday service for the first time. Director Andrew Johnson led a group of about 30 local dignitaries on a ceremonial first trip from Uptown Station in Normal to downtown Bloomington. And he talked with WJBC this week.
Who's going to use the Sunday service? Who is that geared toward?
It's geared to those who work on Sundays. There's a lot of people in retail, hospitality, and the like that have jobs and are at a real disadvantage because the bus system does not run on Sundays. Also, people who want to go to their houses of worship, people that just want to see family and hang out. Life doesn't end on Sunday, so transit service shouldn't end on Sunday either.
Said 27 new drivers or 27 new staff members, many of them drivers, coming on board. Is that too... to help cover the Sunday shift, and they'll be kind of staggered, I'm guessing?
Yeah. Whenever you put new frequency on bus routes, which means more buses, and you extend to a seventh day of the week, you're going to need more drivers. You can't cover that with overtime and things like that. So we're bringing on new drivers. Also, to cope with the new schedule, we brought on some new maintenance staff as well.
This is a new bus here. Give us an update on the fleet and... And longevity.
The fleet is thankfully getting newer. We've taken delivery of seven more of these nice buses that have the new distinctive Connect Transit color scheme. We are hoping to purchase another 10 in the next year or two. And these are really much needed replacements for our aging fleet. And also gives us the ability to expand service to more, to provide more frequency.
I know you rely to some extent on federal funding to be able to make this a go, and it's been a struggle, I'm sure, and the Republican Party platform recently sort of seemed to de-emphasize mass transportation at the federal level, saying it was more of a local concern. If you get this increase in ridership that you're looking for, how do you make that case that you should get more money when there might be fewer dollars to go around?
Well, as you see by the presence of Congressman LaHood and the staffs of all of our other delegation, Connect Transit definitely is making its story known to the federal government. I believe our delegation knows the value of public transportation, knows how important it is to our economy, to keeping people working and keeping people in school and the like. So even though the Republican platform does suggest a catastrophic decrease in funding, I think when it's all said and done, cooler heads will prevail and we'll see public transportation continue to be funded by the federal government because it does so many good things in the community.
I suspect a lot of the people who ride public transit may not have any other options. How do you convince the people that could drive that this is a better option for them?
Well, I think this route restructuring is definitely a step in that direction. For those who do have other options, be it a car or some other form of transportation, you have to provide a convenient service. And our service prior to today was very circuitous. It didn't necessarily make the best use of people's time, kept them on the bus for a long time. You're now able to get where you need to go a lot quicker. We've got increased frequency. You don't have to worry about when the next bus is coming because we've got 15 to 30 minute service on all the routes, and it's a lot easier to take. So somebody who might want to park their car for a day or two and ride the bus, it's going to be a much easier choice.
How long do you think that for that to become habit forming for someone?
We're anticipating that we'll start seeing pretty major ridership gains from this change in the first 12 to 24 months.
And the new app, if you would explain how that can help people with their ride planning.
Yeah, we will have we do have a real-time bus tracking app in place. We just switched over to a new one because, coincidentally, our contract with our vendor was coming to a close, so we switched over from one to the other. But it'll allow you to do trip planning and check where your bus is in real time and take a lot of the guesswork out of where you need to be and what time you need to get out to that bus stop.
And lastly, how do you plan to measure the feedback and how people like this, not just by ridership numbers, but sort of the anecdotal evidence?
Yeah, there is so much more to public transportation than simply how many rides did you provide. So we get out into the community much more and talk to our riders. We'll be doing surveys on board and also surveys of the non-riding public to find out what the attitudes and the expectations are for public transportation. And we've shown in the past, and we will continue in the future, to be very flexible with the ability to make changes when the people want it and when it's warranted.
That was Connect Transit Director Andrew Johnson on WJBC. Best-selling author Elizabeth Berg is paying a visit to Bloomington this weekend, sharing selections from her new book, Make Someone Happy, Favorite Postings, and a signing at the Bloomington Public Library on Sunday. The former nurse has compiled some of her favorite blog entries, which she shared with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Tell everybody where you came up with the concept for this book.
Well, my publisher had been asking me for some time to become a presence on Facebook, which I resisted mightily. I'm just an old curmudgeon with technology. Finally, though, I did start a Facebook page. And I do a lot of posting about just things I'm thinking about. And it seems to strike a chord with people. It seems that they enjoy the post for itself, for which I'm very happy. But also, it sends them off into journeys into their own lives and their own pasts, which I love. I love that it evokes those kinds of things in people. There were people who started saying, you should make a book out of these postings. And then more people said it, and then more people said it. And finally I said, well, fine, I'll do that. It's not the kind of thing that my publisher wanted to do because these were previously published works, even though it was just on Facebook and they were spread out. So this became a way to collect the favorite postings together in one place. As one reader said, I want to have something I can take into the bathtub or on a plane or keep by the bedside at night and read one or two every day. So my best friend designed the cover, and she designed the way the book looks on the inside, and I collected the postings, and here you are.
And you know what? The postings, as I told you before we went on the air here, the postings are something that will touch a chord in anybody who reads this. I finally got through it last night after trying, but I couldn't stop on a page and just go to the next page because just about everything you wrote there made me remember something parallel in my life, and that's awfully nice that you're able to do that.
I love when that happens. Yeah, I'll tell you an example. Today I posted about I went for a walk and I didn't bring money with me, and you should never do that in the summer because you might run into a lemonade stand. And so I was writing about that, and then one of the readers posted his own story, which is hysterical, about buying lemonade from a kid. He asked the kid, there was pink and yellow lemonade. He asked the kid, which one's colder? And the kid stuck his finger in both of the lemonade and told him which one. And then he said, well, which one tastes better? And the kid drank from both.
Oh, my gosh.
Said this one. So, you know, it's delightful for me to share these memories or these thoughts or even these confusions. And sometimes even things that are poignant, and understand that there is a kind of miraculously created family out there in cyberspace. As much as I rag on technology, this is a quite wonderful thing, so that you're not alone and that you do go on these journeys into your own past. Oh, I remember intimate perfume, or I remember this, or I love chocolate ice cream with marshmallows. It makes a family of the world, and I think that in today's climate, where so many of us are anxious and confused and afraid, it feels really good to feel at home, even if it's artificial.
100% right there. And with everything that's going on, it's nice to take a journey away from all that stuff and read some nice stuff once in a while. Do you mind if I just kind of knock a couple of them at you here? And like I said, we don't have time to read them all, but the ones that really touched me were about your dogs. And in particular, the piece you put on there about Homer, which was your old dog that was nearing the end of his life. And it just... I just sat there and went, oh my gosh, this is so good. And it reminds me of my dog, Kobe, and stuff like that. And then your conversations with your dog, Gabby. I mean, it was, you made Gabby a real person. Tell me about Homer and Gabby.
I'm very happy that you called her out, by the way.
Yeah. It's great. So, and that's something that everybody can relate to. Being able to talk to your dogs, and we all have conversations with them, but your piece about Homer was just it just yanked at your heart because everybody's been there too.
Yeah, I think everyone who cares for dogs feels the same way about old dogs. You know, they get to that time. Somebody needs to figure this out so that dogs live exactly as long as their owners do. But
until
that time, we'll learn a lot of lessons from their grace and fortitude and acceptance.
Yeah.
They're just wonderful beings.
And you know what, Elizabeth, out of that essay about that blog, about that posting about Homer, was the one line where it said, "And Homer came over and laid down next to me."
Mm-hmm.
And who hasn't experienced that? And this book of yours, Make Someone Happy, it's full of things that will not only make you just remember stuff, it'll make you feel stuff too. And that's a real credit to you as a writer to be able to make people feel things.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's certainly the intention is to share not only an event, but all the feelings that come from it. And my reward is the richness in other people that lets them do that. And then they're generous enough to tell me that they felt that too.
Yeah,
it's a really good feeling. It makes you happy.
That was author Elizabeth Berg with Dan Swain. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Where do the happiest people in the world live? Survey after survey show inhabitants of the small northern European land of Denmark are the happiest people, and an author suggests that Danes foster happiness from the youngest age. Jessica Alexander is the author of The Danish Way of Parenting. She talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
As an American, did you have a different approach in your mind to raising kids when you moved abroad with your Danish husband?
Yes, I think I had a completely different approach in mind, and it was through my relationship with my Danish husband and my Danish family and my experiences in Denmark that slowly, even before I had kids, made me start questioning how I had been raised and the American way of parenting. I think that what we don't realize sometimes as parents is that we often question who we are as parents, but we never question how our culture affects what we think is the right way and whether that could be changed. And I was very inspired to find out that the Danish happiness reports and how they've been constantly voted the happiest people in the world, that there must be something in this Danish model that's really working.
Well, when you started your family and you began to sort of parent from the perspective of the ingrained habits we all have and thoughts we have in our own culture of raising kids, was there a point where you came into any conflict with your husband, raised in a different culture, when it came to approaching parenting?
Yes, so these were some of the debates we had, often like about disciplining, for example, because I came from a more strict family. And I think in America, there's in a lot of families a tendency to use more fear-based approach. And in Denmark, it's an extremely democratic approach. So this is actually one of the chapters we talk called No Ultimatums Parenting. And they don't immediately go into these power struggles. So we had talked about it a lot and debated it a lot. But I think also I was very inspired because all the years I've been in Denmark, I've been extremely blown away by how well-behaved, serene, and happy kids are. they are something out of, I don't know, a storybook. And so what I began to realize was, although this way was very different than what I had had in mind, it was clearly working with the kids because they were responding to it.
Let's talk about an example there, because I think most American parents, anyway, have that idea of the ultimatum parenting. You know, the very least saying, if you don't do this, then no TV. Or, you know, to set up a consequence to say one of these power plays, really, that you have with your kids.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How do you not do that? Because ultimately, you know, there are only so many tools.
This is what's so interesting when you take it from a cultural standpoint, is because so that language we use, those ultimatums, so much of that is just coming from our culture. So we have kind of an I win culture, and that is also affected in our parenting. And so much of what we say, we're just saying because our parents said it to us. We're very much, we don't get any training in parenting, so we're sort of repeating often what we hear and without questioning it. But what happens with this I win, you lose approach is that it's often the parents lose, because you lose closeness with your kids when they're afraid of you. You lose respect because often we can't follow through with these threats, and then the kids don't know if the boundaries are really exist for real. And we lose perspective because we get caught up in these little battles rather than the war of sort of what are our big family values. So Danes, they, by avoiding this, and I think by fundamentally they see children as good, and not, they don't go directly into like labeling them and punishing them. Instead, they try to avoid problems, which is like a whole mind shift. Spanking is illegal in Denmark. It's been illegal for more than 20 years, which is quite interesting. And what we find is that kids respond to being respected. So let me give you another example in the language. In English, we call the toddler years the terrible twos. In Denmark, they call the toddler years trods alder, which means the boundary-pushing age. And so instead of seeing that age as terrible, they see it as healthy, and they welcome it, and they see the kids pushing boundaries as something completely natural. And again, the way you choose to see a child directly affects the way you treat them. So sometimes just really this mind shift has a huge knock-on effect.
Okay, so let's set up a scenario wherein, let's say you're in the supermarket in Denmark, and you see one of those kids that's pushing boundaries, maybe having a meltdown in aisle number 5, you know, just throwing themselves on the floor or something like that. What's the approach that the Danish way of parenting would take in trying to deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I would say that you see this a lot less in Denmark. This is what is so, what really struck me. You see that meltdown, so you almost never see it. You see it a lot more frequently here. You also don't hear yelling. So I think because they've already started this at a very young age, this whole teach respect, be respectful, and you will be respected, you just automatically get less of these meltdowns. But Danes, they try very hard to explain the rules, even to babies. They're very empathic, so they teach empathy in schools, already in preschool. So they're very much trying to understand their children's emotions and make them feel heard. So if a kid's having a meltdown, first of all, the Dane will try to acknowledge their emotion. So like, you're mad. I can see you're mad. And this may sound silly, but you would be amazed how responsive little kids are to feeling like their emotion is being heard. You know, because when they're really little, they don't have the skills to self-regulate their emotions. And I'm not saying that it's a foolproof, like, rule book that it works every time, but this is more of a philosophy that if you implement it, you see huge results from being more of like this lighthouse as a parent rather than, you know, basing it on sort of fear and threats.
We're talking with Jessica Alexander. She's the co-author of The Danish Way of Parenting. One of the approaches that you cover in this book that might be counterintuitive, similar to the no ultimatum approach, is you suggest playtime is as important, if not more important, then learning time. Of course, we have these other cultures with very strict approaches toward education and work and building a work ethic and almost a fear of if you don't get a high mark that you're underperforming. You say the Danish way of parenting is opposite of that. Playtime is as important.
Yes. So since 1871 in Denmark, play has been considered an educational theory. So they see it as the most important thing a child can do up up until, you know, they start school, basically, and then even in school it's important, but they don't believe in over-programming their kids' lives because they fundamentally believe that children learn so much from playing. And in America, we're starting to hear this more and more and more, that play is important for kids. All the research is showing what it's teaching our kids, things like empathy, coping skills, it reduces anxiety. And yet, I think the reason that we haven't implemented it more is because we can't measure it. And, you know, here in this country, we really like to measure things to prove that it's working. But what I would point out from the book is to say, here we have a country that for 40 years in a row is voted as the happiest people in the world, who implements a lot of free play. And I think that that is very compelling evidence that letting our kids play more is really working and improving their well-being.
And our play here is often very regulated itself. And I wonder if that gets into a philosophy of what kids are exposed to and what we consider the safe areas for them. Are American kids, in your estimation, more sheltered than what you see in Denmark?
Yes, definitely. But I think that also comes from this idea that we kind of feel that we have to also program their lives all the time. I think we pressure each other as parents here and as a society that we constantly feel guilty if we're not, you know, constantly having them enrolled in something. And I think that's something that would be great if we could get out of and start supporting each other in the fact that letting your kids play and stepping back and letting them also handle some of their own problems is not lazy. It is the educated choice. And that would be the greatest mind shift, I think, if we could get into, because we used to have a lot more free play in America. It's just this idea of more and more courses, more and more competition has sort of taken over that playtime that kids used to have.
That was author Jessica Alexander with Steve Fast. And it's rare for a baseball team to add to its coaching staff in mid-August, and that's not the most unusual aspect of the Normal Corn Belters' newest hire. Justine Siegel, who has worked for several major league teams, is the first ever female coach hired in the Frontier League. Siegel talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
I imagine you came up against barrier after barrier after barrier, and you broke through.
Yeah, I've been playing baseball since T-ball, and I had a really good time. And then when I was 13 was the first time my new coach said he didn't want me on his team. He thought girls should go play softball. But I loved baseball, so I decided then I'd play baseball forever. And I kept playing through high school, and it was 16 when I said it, I wanted to be a baseball coach. And I told my other baseball coach, and he laughed at me. And he said a man would never listen to a woman on a baseball field. So I just sort of decided then, like, who's he to limit me and who's he to limit all men? So I, you know, started working on coaching.
So as a baseball player, where did girls get the opportunity to play?
Sure. Well, legally, girls can go play with their youth baseball leagues. It's just that many girls don't feel welcome. But I played, you know, just on my youth league in Cleveland. I played with my brother for quite a bit. He ended up stopped playing, and I kept going. And
who was the better player, you or your brother?
I was the better player, but I also worked a lot harder.
Yeah. So talk about, you're the founder of an organization called Baseball for All.
Sure. Baseball for All is a national nonprofit encouraging girls to play baseball. We just held our nationals tournament in San Francisco a couple weeks ago with 18 teams. So I basically teach communities how to start girls' baseball programs and then give them opportunities to play with other teams.
So why do you think softball is, you know, globally accepted with women and girls playing softball? Baseball isn't.
Yeah, baseball's growing around the world for women. We were just Team USA won gold in the Pan Am Games, and the Women's World Cup is in Korea in just a couple weeks. In fact, I gave up that that trip to be here, which was obviously the best choice. But so it's growing. But I think that when Little League was asked to put women or girls in its program, it just chose to put a softball program together instead of girls' baseball.
And when did this begin? This Baseball for All. When did
Baseball
you start that?
For All, I founded it in 2010. And basically any girl who wants to play, coach, or umpire baseball, they can go to our website, baseballforall.com, and get more info.
And how much has the likes of like a Monique Davis, who we all saw and everyone was rooting for in the Little League World Series, she did very well. How much has that done for your program?
Yeah, Monique did a great job showing that girls want to play baseball. She performed unbelievably under such pressure. You know, but there's lots of Monique Davises out there. I don't want to say lots of her level, but the lots of girls who want to play. Yeah. And I think that the next question was, well, where are all the other girls? And that's what Baseball for All is helping to give those opportunities.
Do you see a day when it'll be an Olympic sport maybe? We've had softball, and it's coming back. Softball's coming back.
Yeah, I think it can be an Olympic sport. I'm the chair of the Women's Commission for the WBSC, which is in charge of growing it to become an Olympic sport. So I think it's definitely doable.
All right, now we're going to go back a little history and your career in coaching and how you made it to the professional level. Where'd you start coaching?
Sure. Well, after starting at 16 with camps and so on, I then went on and got my PhD in sports psychology at Springfield College, and I spent 3 years as an assistant college baseball coach. I was the only woman in the country at that time.
Were you the first woman in the country?
I am not. I'm the second.
Okay.
And no one else has done it, I don't think, after. But that's not really – you don't want to be the first. You know, you want everyone to have the opportunity. But from there, I coached with the Brockton Rocks, which was an independent pro teams in Brockton, Massachusetts.
My family's from Brockton, Massachusetts.
Yeah. That's what I was doing in 2009. And then in 2011, I had the opportunity to throw batting practice to six major league teams.
How did that come about? How did you get invited to throw batting practice?
Oh, no, I made it happen.
How'd you make it happen?
I sent emails to general managers and people didn't respond, so I went to the winter meetings, and then I asked Joe Maddon, who was with the Rays at the time.
Cubs coach now?
Yes, and he's like, well, maybe. Here's my email. And then asked Billy Bean with the A's, and he took 5 seconds and said, sure. And then because I'm from Cleveland, I then contacted the Indians and said, hey, I want to make history with you. Let's do this. And they're like, yeah, let's do it.
That was new Corn Belters coach Justine Siegel with Scott Laughlin. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Many packed and late buses led to many angry parents in Unit 5 this week. First Student is the company hired to pick up and drop off students in the district. First Student spokeswoman Marlena Wolf is apologizing.
From First Student, I would like to extend an apology to the district and to the families, the parents. On behalf of First Student, we understand that it's been inconvenient and it's not been easy for everyone, but we just want to, you know, try to gain the trust back.
There are also reports about late buses and students having to sit on the floor. School officials have said it'll take several days to get all of the problems resolved. Well, the students were back in school on Thursday at St. Mary's Catholic School in Bloomington, but the school is still cleaning up after a mess left by a group of juveniles earlier this summer. Principal Jamie Hartrick says they're putting wax down on the floor in the main hallway as it was closed off on the first day, creating some inconvenience.
There was a lot of rerouting everybody going around the long way, so classes didn't start on time, but they were able to at least be here.
4 juveniles have been charged with the vandalism. A nurse at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center is being remembered following a 2-vehicle wreck near Streeter that took her life. 23-year-old Allie Stevenson of Bloomington went to Illinois Wesleyan. The woman that recruited her for the golf program, Kathy Niepagan, remembers the young nurse and her caring nature.
She never had a bad thing to say about anyone. She could pick you up quicker than anything just by her smile and her presence in the room. And she had a very calming effect. And I think that's why she went on into nursing. And she was a great nurse out at OSF.
After months of discussion, a plan to bring a near $53 million hotel and conference center in downtown Bloomington is officially no more. At Monday night's Bloomington City Council Committee of the Whole meeting, the council saw a presentation from consultant Steve Friedman, which highlighted a number of deficiencies with a plan that would have seen the front and center building transformed into a 129-key hotel and conference center. Mayor Terry Renner says had it not been such a financial gamble for the city, the plan could have won support.
If we had $37 million and they had guaranteed this is what we're bringing to the table, we could show that we were not paying, the project wasn't costing too much because of excessive spending on the property, I think we would very likely have had a majority.
A McLean County judge has ordered a former fire official to spend 4 months in jail and serve 2.5 years probation for stealing from the department where he served as chief. 31-year-old Josh Detterding of Atlanta was ordered to repay more than $10,000 to Allen Township's insurance carrier and cover attorney and accounting fees that the township incurred while trying to recover the stolen money. Detterding had pleaded guilty in April. And Senator Dick Durbin is saying he has no plans to run for governor.
Listen, I've got a great job. I enjoy representing the state of Illinois. Honored to do it, Washington, D.C. I try my best to help our state out in every way. I am not angling for any other spot, any other office. I'm not soliciting it. What I basically said is I'm going to continue to do my job and let the speculation go where it wants to.
Durbin tells WJBC's Scott Laughlin some polls have shown he would fare well against Governor Bruce Rauner, but Durbin didn't initiate any such research. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, the Bloomington City Council will set a public hearing on a proposed tax increment financing district for downtown. Monday also marks the first day of classes at Illinois State University and Heartland Community College, while on Tuesday, new students begin to arrive on the Illinois Wesleyan campus. On Friday, we kick off the high school football season with our WJBC extravaganza, with live coverage of all the inner-city openers, plus a few from the area, too. And on Friday and Saturday, the Brewula Beer and Wine Festival returns to the corn crib in Normal, where it moved last summer. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.